This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello, and welcome to LGIM Talks. My name is Alyssa Ford, and I'm joined today by Laura Brown, Head of Client Solutions.
Hello.
Stuart Hitchcock, Head of Portfolio Management Private Credit.
Hi, Alyssa.
And Private Credit Portfolio Manager Sam Jones.
Hello.
To talk about secure income assets. Now, 2020 was an extraordinary year for society, individuals and markets, and many investors will be taking a long, hard look at how their portfolios performed and also considering how they're likely to be affected by some of the changes wrought by the pandemic. Although many of the measures implemented by central banks and governments were intended to tackle short-term challenges, they're also likely to have some longer-term effects, which consequently are going to be important for longer-term investors. So when it comes to looking at what portfolios are invested in, Stuart, perhaps you could explain what secure income assets actually are and also what sort of characteristics they have in comparison to other asset classes.
Sure. So secure income assets are those that generate long-term cash flows, and they're based upon investment in what is commonly referred to as private credit. And private credit is defined, I think, pretty simply in a debt context as investments in assets not traded on a public exchange. The financings are typically undertaken on a loan or note format, and they're also negotiated instruments, meaning that they can be crafted to balance the preferences of the borrower and the needs of the investor, whether that's maturity, repayment profile, covenants and currency, amongst other things. In many ways, these financings look and operate much like a fixed rate loan or bond, although the financing itself doesn't have to be in a fixed rate. The private credit universe, if that's the best way to describe it, encompasses a range of investable asset classes, principal of which are private corporate debt, infrastructure debt, and real estate debt. And these assets are typically bought on a buy and hold basis by institutional investors who are looking to match longer term liabilities. Unlike other markets, there is no minimum benchmark size or maturity, so it really is flexible and can be crafted, and that makes it very complementary to public markets for both investors and borrowers. Financings can range from low single millions to multiple billion. They can be undertaken on bilateral, club, or more widely syndicated basis, and in maturities from less than 1 to greater than 50 years, with the heartland maturities of different asset classes and subsectors at different points. Given that backdrop, there really is a breadth of opportunity unavailable in other markets in terms of issuer, sector, and financing structure. Now, since the assets are typically not listed, they are generally viewed as illiquid. And because of that, the quid pro quo of investing in private financings is the provision of structural protections in the form of financial and non-financial covenants. These are features that are designed to help preserve value if an investment does not perform as expected. And this is a key differentiator of private and public markets. Investments themselves may or may not be secured, and that's very much a function of the asset class and the quality of borrower. Importantly, investors can have a relationship with the issuers, and that really drives better ongoing asset management. And because of this, the private asset classes have had superior recovery rates than the public market equivalents. As an aside, it's actually worth noting that a good portion of private investments are actually more liquid than one might think. I think it's also fair to say that in times of volatility, public markets are often not as liquid as one would think.
Thanks, Stuart. So it sounds like a very diverse asset class. And also actually in comparison to kind of leveraged areas of the market, it sounds a bit more, well, not exactly boring, that's not the right word, but certainly more vanilla. Is that a fair comment?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's really important at this stage to dispel a couple of common misconceptions about the private credit markets generally. The first, I think, is that private credit is universally complex and leveraged, and that is absolutely not true. In fact, it couldn't be further from reality for the most part, and certainly in the parts of the market that we look at. Although leveraged finance constitutes a significant part of the wider private credit universe, the large established markets in which we participate are focused on the investment grade and crossover rating spaces. And when I say crossover, I'm really referring here to BB equivalent credit quality. So our investment range is really from AAA through to BB equivalent. Often financings are on very vanilla structures akin to bank or bond financings. And these markets are actually accessed by the very largest multinational public corporates, high-profile infrastructure projects and landmark properties who are looking to diversify their investor base and optimize their debt maturity profile. And of course, there is investment in much smaller organizations, projects and assets. I think the second misconception is that private credit is somehow a newfangled concept. Again, that is absolutely not true. The asset classes that we focus on have been in existence for decades, are well-established and with established fundraising and legal processes.
So it's like private credit is the new black. Well, with all of those characteristics in mind, Laura, perhaps you could tell us a bit about what role private credit or secure income assets could actually play in investors' portfolios.
Yes. So from our perspective, private credit assets offer a really nice opportunity to get returns in excess of gilts, but in a way that is linked to contractual cash flows and can help provide the income needed to pay pensions. If we look at defined benefit schemes in particular, an awful lot of our clients, our research shows, are in a position now where they're pretty well funded, things are going well, often a lot of assets have been allocated to LDI already. And actually, when we look at the sort of the best way to optimize member outcomes in terms of the proportion of benefits met in different scenarios, we see a lot of opportunities for clients to reallocate some of their gilt assets and think about asset classes like private credit, which give a little bit more return. So typically the sort of portfolios we look at might be around gilts plus 2.5% per annum, and help them get to full funding faster. And the rationale there really is that for many, many clients where covenant can be an issue, if you're able to get to buy out sooner rather than later, then that's better from the perspective of your members and the likelihood of them getting their benefits. So yes, secure income assets are really helpful from that point of view. And of course, many clients in that position are also very focused on cash flow. So again, a really nice part of the portfolio to deliver those cash flows that we need to pay pensions.
So Laura, how important is ESG for clients at the moment?
So we are finding that it's absolutely at the heart of everything that our clients are thinking about at the moment. I guess, you know, the sort of wider post-pandemic backdrop is contributing to that, but also regulation, changing burden on trustees to think about these kind of topics. And private credit and secure income type of assets really do provide a very strong sort of natural fit with clients thinking about ESG kinds of objectives. From our perspective, there are probably three key aspects to that. The first is understanding the financial materiality of some of these ESG factors in the way it feeds into private credit. So, you know, things like climate change and the impact that might have on the kind of physical risk of some of our investments, you know, understanding how the energy transition might play out in some of the opportunities we're looking at. We've invested an awful lot in the research to enable us to think about that over time, and that's obviously fundamental. The second is around investment stewardship and really thinking about how we use our role to make a difference to society. And of course, private assets lend themselves really nicely to that, and kind of lead into the third point, which is that we are able to hold borrowers to account. The bespoke nature of each transaction means that we can feed in. We can obviously not get involved if we don't believe that the right ESG and impact credentials are there. But we can also capture in the documentation requirements around the use of proceeds of the loans that we make, requirements around the properties that we're securing the debt against. Those kind of things can be really helpful in terms of actually driving a positive change and making a difference, which we hope is attractive from an investor perspective as well.
Thanks, Laura. So just to pick up on your comment about the pandemic, and perhaps this is a question for Stuart, thinking about your experience in private markets where you've been working for some time, how do you think the recent pandemic has or will affect secure income assets moving forward?
Well, I think this is a really interesting one because I think there are both conceptual and practical spotlights you can shine on the subject. I think if we look at things from a funding perspective, traditionally banks have been the primary source of funding for all manner of borrowers, if not the primary source of funding. But new funders have entered the market. Specifically, that means pension funds and insurers who are offering longer term funding to match their liabilities. This is much more reflective of the US funding markets. We saw a large increase in private market funding in the early 2000s, but then a real step change in borrowing behaviour following the financial crisis, where liquidity was more scarce in various sectors and credit spaces, and borrowers looked to better diversify their lending group and maturity profile. That resulted in quite a sizable increase in private credit issuance across sectors that only sporadically access institutional money in the past. And that has had a positive effect on growing knowledge and comfort of lending into different sectors. I think this crisis has re-elevated some of those underlying fundamental themes. I mean, if we look at the theoretical risks of a liquidity shortage, well, now they have been fully demonstrated in real practical terms with the economy in various places grinding to a complete halt. And this is different to the global financial crisis. So I think the adage of using institutional markets for core debt funding and banks for liquidity purposes is in the spotlight again. I think it's also fair to say that the events of the past year have shone an important light on what we at L&G call inclusive capitalism, where investment is used as a force for good. I genuinely think that this crisis could act as a catalyst for further investor demand in social and environmental solutions with real world impact. This is something we are already seeing. I guess the question is how much of the expected focus on institutional investing is going to be temporary or a structural shift, and whether this pandemic accelerates that movement again. I personally think the COVID crisis will accelerate that shift, but for different reasons to the GFC.
Can you give a sense of the size of the opportunity that you see across private credit markets, and also explain a little bit about how you source and select opportunities here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the size and the growth of the markets never really fails to surprise me, having been in them for two decades. And to put the size of opportunity in perspective, if we take the annual sterling denominated private debt markets alone, we estimate that the opportunity set is in excess of £120 billion across the corporate infrastructure and real estate debt spaces combined. And that's split broadly equally across those sectors.
Thanks, Stuart. So, Sam, where do you see the opportunities in this asset class as we emerge from the pandemic?
There is an increased momentum in private market credit activity, and we do not see that abating. Ultimately, we feel that our traditional range of sectors will continue to offer opportunities for investment, and potentially in greater supply than historic levels due to the continued institutional funding shift. However, if we look beyond the pandemic, we also think there are some key growth drivers that will support further investment opportunities and aid the recovery. These drivers include aging demographics, investment in the real economy, technological innovation, globalization of asset markets, welfare reforms, and lastly, but definitely not least, addressing climate change. Delving into these drivers a little further and where there could be opportunities. From a social perspective, healthcare and housing will continue to be elevated in governmental importance. The UK continues to suffer from a shortage of affordable housing, and private capital will play a core role in helping reduce the gap. In infrastructure, we continue to see increased renewable activity, particularly in wind, solar, and hydro, as the world moves to a more environmentally friendly sources of power. With increasingly ambitious climate change targets, the number and scale of projects will only rise further. We also see further developments in the digital space, which includes fiber networks and data centers. This crisis has very much demonstrated the importance of digital communication, so significant necessary investment will be a key national focus as we move forward. Lastly, in real estate, structural shifts in consumer behaviour should continue to support the distribution and logistics sectors, and housing demand will continue to drive growth in the private rented sector. It's also worth adding that despite the majority of us currently working from home, we also believe offices in core locations will continue to see strong tenant demand despite recent events.
Thanks, Sam. So it sounds like there are lots of potential opportunities out there, and some with extremely strong ties to ESG factors and, you know, building a cleaner and greener future. So just to step away from the asset class itself for a moment and look at how investors can access it. Laura, perhaps you can tell us a bit about how this has changed, because I think even though secure income assets, private credit have been around for a while, traditionally, they haven't necessarily been on investors' radar. Is there an access reason for that? And is that changing?
Yes, I think things are changing. So historically, this asset class, I think, was mainly accessed by sort of larger, sophisticated clients who had a lot of sort of governance budget to apply in this space. And indeed, some of the largest pension schemes in the UK had their own in-house teams sourcing assets or overseeing asset managers working for them to look at assets. And it was all very, very bespoke. What we've been looking at and thinking about over the last few years is really how to make the asset class more readily available to a wider group of investors. And there's a number of aspects to this, I think. The first of which is around fund structure. So increasingly now we're looking to provide opportunities that are within standard types of pooled fund product ranges. Historically, when clients were signing up to funds in this space, it would be quite different from the kinds of funds they were used to dealing with, closed-ended structures, different types of legals that could all make things really quite onerous from the perspective of a sort of medium-sized pension scheme client. And so that's really changing now to make things much more within the standard pooled fund framework. So I think that's really helpful. The other part of the puzzle is around the importance of looking at things from a sort of multi-asset perspective. Again, a barrier for many pension schemes has been to decide which part of this universe to play in. We see dedicated infrastructure debt funds or dedicated niches of different areas. And I think clients are looking for fund managers to have funds where we find relative value through the cycle. If the last year, I suppose, has taught us anything, it's that we need to be nimble. And this is a really good example of where fund managers can be nimble on behalf of their clients and capture relative value across sectors. So I think the availability of multi-asset funds in this space is super, super important.
Thanks, Laura. And thank you for listening to this episode of LGIM Talks. For more information about this podcast and the topics we've discussed today, please visit the LGIM website, and we hope you'll tune in again soon.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgim.com.